This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Although construction on the I-77 toll lanes north of Charlotte has begun, opposition to those lanes continues, and now political fallout is beginning to spread for those who demonstrate support for the project. We get an update on all of that later in the program. First, Chief Kerr Putney has now been on the job as head of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department for a year. In that time, the department endured a divisive trial and witnessed a rise in crime, including the incidents of home invasions. We've invited Chief Putney to join us to reflect on his first year at the helm and to talk about the future and what the addition of more officers may mean for the city. Chief Putney, welcome back.
Good to see you. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
You took control of the department, as I said, at a divisive time. A trial was going on that occurred over an incident that occurred during your predecessor's tenure in your office. You've said that that trial nearly tore your department apart. Has the damage been repaired?
Well, what we have been able to do is focus on the priority of ensuring public safety. We've done a lot of healing internally, and we're moving forward, ready to start with the additional 63 officers and 25 civilian support staff, start impacting this violent crime and the rise in property crime that we're experiencing year-to-date in Charlotte.
That trial was because of a police officer who was accused of shooting an unarmed black man. Have policies or procedures at the department substantially changed since that trial or since that incident, for that matter?
We're always reviewing our policies, but what we've really done is double down on our educational process, training around cultural proficiency and so forth, and trying to connect with people. I say it's hard to hate up close, so we're just connecting our officers with members of the community. Our officers are going in out of uniform in plain clothes and connecting with people on a human level and trying to really show Charlotte what CMPD is all about.
They're going in plain clothes as police identified as police officers,
yeah,
not
just
undercover.
Engaging in conversation, yes, and we're out of uniform so that we can reduce those barriers.
What do you mean by cultural proficiency?
Mainly, we want to connect on a human level, have people understand that we're there to better understand them and that we're all human. At the end of the day, we do a job, which is ensuring public safety, but we're humans just like they are, and making sure we establish those relationships, which is part of our mission, and that we continue to fight crime and engage our community.
Crime rates seem to ebb and flow. Right now, by your own reporting, there has been a significant, I believe that's your word, a significant rise in crime over the past year. What kinds of crime?
Well, we're up about 17% in violent crime overall and another 15% in property crime. Property crime is driven mostly by our larcenies, and we're making some headway around our burglaries, which were up just slightly. But ultimately, it's our larcenies with property crime and our ag assaults in the area of violent crime.
Yeah, as I understand it, violent crime is up 18.2%. Property crimes rose 8.6%. Homicides rose 36.4%. Percentages can be deceiving. How many incidents are we talking about here?
Sure. Well, year-to-date, we're actually down homicide-wise. We last year, at this time, we had 22. Now had 25, and now we have 22. So slightly down. Percentages can be misleading. We can claim that we're down 23% with homicides, but every homicide matters. It's a life. So being down just three lives is nothing to celebrate too much.
So how do you explain the rise and fall of these various different kinds of crimes?
A lot of dynamics. Ultimately, though, our contribution is our presence and our ability to be proactive, and that's been really hampered by the fact that Charlotte has grown and our organization has not. Mm. So the requests for 125 and 80, we got half of that this first year, and we expect that to add an additional 130,000 service hours from our police department to impact those crime rates.
Until several years ago, I don't recall ever hearing of a home invasion. That was a new term to me.
Sure.
And if I'm right about this, there was a 50% spike in home invasions. That's correct?
And our issue around home invasions, too, is 51% involve drugs. So it's not like they're so random. People are specifically kicking in doors of people, for the most part, that they know.
Right.
And a lot of times it's around drug distribution.
156 home invasions, half over drugs. In the other half, why are people invading people's homes?
Because they're having issues with one another. Some way, most of them are associated. They know each other. And it's a way to intimidate and increase fear And people, unfortunately, are resorting to that to solve their issues. I don't know what the resolution is. It doesn't make sense to you and me, but that's exactly how they're behaving.
So in most of these home invasions, the perpetrators know the victims and vice versa?
The vast majority, absolutely.
So they're just resorting to a new tactic to get a resolution of whatever their dispute may be?
Well, it's not really a new tactic. They're just doing it more often than they have in the past.
Wow. Why now? Well, because as I said, I don't recall ever hearing about this before 5 or 6 years ago.
Sure. Really, it was the terminology is still basically a break-in, but the home invasion is because it incites a lot more fear. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, as I said before, it's around intimidation. So people are – the other thing is the gun violence. Mike, you talk about what's disturbing. People are resorting to gun violence to solve minor disputes. Mm-hmm. So most concerning are the violent crime issues associated with both of those.
Why is that happening? Why are people using more guns to solve relatively minor disputes? What's that all about?
If I knew exactly, I wouldn't tell anybody. I'd put it on the free market and sell it and make $1 billion. It's so multifaceted. It really is. The struggle is we have people who are behaving a lot. Some of them are behaving like gang members. Some of them actually are gang members who have resorted to violence in the past and continue to do so. And others are just people who think, for some reason, that is the best way to solve a small conflict, is resorting to the use of a firearm. They're shooting into occupied houses and so forth and just behaving poorly.
Is it that they think life is cheap, life is worthless, that they have – what is it that they don't see another way out, they don't understand conflict resolution, they're afraid the other side wouldn't stand for conflict resolution because they have a gun too, and if they don't use theirs first, they're going down? What's operating here?
It is D, all of the above. All of the above. It's various layers of all of those, Mike. Unfortunately, I think some of it too is people have denigrated their behavior to such that threatening others' lives isn't really an important matter to them.
You may not know the answer to this question, but are the guns being used in most of these offensives legally obtained guns?
That we don't know precisely, but what we can tell you is a lot of the repeat offenders that we catch with those guns that are being used are obtained illegally.
And where do they get them?
They steal them from just about everywhere, ultimately primarily from vehicles where they target the vehicles, break in, especially unopened doors in the vehicles, and they rummage through the car until they get lucky and find a firearm.
Are the penalties for being discovered with an illegal firearm or for using an illegal firearm sufficient in your mind?
Well, I don't know that. I think the penalty is okay. It's just capacity. Our issue is, we have so many instances of gun violence and people stealing firearms that we don't prosecute them as much as we should, I think.
Because we can't.
Just because of capacity, absolutely. There's so many, and there's so few prosecutors that we have here. Underfunded prosecution means a lot of people aren't going to be prosecuted who should be. And in particular, the gun violence and the gun possession are crimes that we see as we don't have the capacity to prosecute them as we should.
So what happens to them? They just are set free?
Well, first offense probably, and it takes them escalating their violence or us repeatedly catching them before we can actually prioritize enough to get them prosecuted.
And that sends a message, doesn't it?
Well, unfortunately, it does send a message. Message is clear to me. We need to better fund our justice system, especially in the area of prosecution.
How many of these – you say we have so many crimes being committed with guns or so many incidents involving illegal guns and maybe legal guns as well. How many are we talking about here?
Well, year-to-date, you're looking at about 1,600. So
put that into some sort of perspective for a city this size.
Well, if you're looking at, in a year, 3,000 gun possessions and offenses, it's pretty substantial. And our issue is that just – scratches the surface. Those are just people pointing guns or actually firing guns. That has nothing to do with those crimes that are unreported because, people just have kind of lost confidence that we're going to be able to do much about those offenses.
Is that loss of confidence justified?
I don't think so. I had somebody ask me, a community member asked me the other day to help him understand how he should have hope, hope in the city, hope in the system. And I said, that's a different institution if you're looking for hope. That's not something that we can really deliver, I don't think. But what I can tell you is our contribution is the heroic work our officers are doing. They're putting themselves in harm's way. They're running towards gunfire when others have the ability to run away. And they're performing heroically to make sure that the city's as safe as we can make it.
Is it a PR problem then? I mean, if somebody's asking you for hope in the system, what they're telling you, it seems to me, is that they don't have any confidence in the system. The system is not working properly, and it's not deterring crime, and the criminals who have committed the crimes are getting set free because of the lack of capacity. So is that what they're asking, or is it a PR problem where people just don't know how much work is being done behind the scenes?
I think it's the latter. I also think, though, it's what you focus on. If all you're going to focus on are the fact that we can't prosecute everybody that commits a crime, then, yeah, that makes you have less hope. But if you're focused on the fact that we're also turning quite a few lives around, we're having people who first encounter or engage in criminal activity who turn their lives around, get gainfully employed, and then positively contribute to the city,
right.
That is a bit more inspiring. That's what gives me hope.
So I got the percentage of homicides wrong, so let me make sure I have the number of homicides correct. As I understand it, so there were 60 homicides in 2015, correct?
Yes, full year. Yes.
And how many of those cases did the victim know the perpetrator?
It ranges roughly in the 70 to 80% range. For the most part, they're not random acts, but the issue is just about every year we'll have 10 or 15% that are domestic related. So they do know their partner, but it's an intimate relationship, and it's much harder to predict from the outside exactly what's going on to contribute to those homicides.
And you have said that those crimes occurred even though your officers are working harder than ever. Is that why you asked City Council for 125 additional police officers and more support personnel as well?
Absolutely. They're working as hard as they can. It's just a matter of capacity for us as well. We don't have the capacity. And 63 is a good step in the right direction. I'm glad City Council was true to their word. They said public safety is their number one priority, and they put the money where their mouth was.
Well, CMPD, as I understand it, is already larger per capita. We have more police officers per capita than some similarly sized cities to which we compare ourselves frequently, like Columbus, San Francisco, San Jose, Indianapolis, Jacksonville, and Austin. We have a lower crime rate than all of those cities except for San Jose. So why do we need more cops than they have?
I wish it were as simple as a formula. I wish it were as simple as a ratio. All of those jurisdictions, which is why we're looking at how we can better compare ourselves to similar sized cities. And also, we need to focus on the Southeast. What happens in San Jose is totally different from here. I was out in that area for the Super Bowl, and I can tell you the dynamics in San Jose are not similar to Charlotte.
They're, what does that mean?
Median income out there is much higher.
Right.
The opportunities out there, much different. And the level of diversity.
Well, the median income is higher, but then the cost of living is also higher. So isn't it a wash in some cases?
Not really. If you have more affluence, more money, you have more opportunities. And it goes back to the hope conversation that we had earlier.
Okay.
Our people here aren't as affluent. And they're, in some cases, much more frustrated. And this is the South, so there are a lot more guns.
So we'll talk about the influence that you hope these additional officers will have on your ability to get a handle on this crime problem. Chief Kerr Putney's with us. Chief of CMPD will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Ira Glass for an evening of stories and dance and the production of Three Acts, Two Dancers, and One Radio Host, Saturday at Belk Theater. Tickets online at BlumenthalArts.org. Mecklenburg County Commissioners give themselves a raise while CMS rolls out new guidelines on how to handle transgender students. FAA policy seems to settle the struggle over control of Charlotte's airport, at least for now. The legislature won't be stopping the I-77 toll lanes in this session, and health officials investigate a death from a rare brain-eating amoeba possibly contracted at the Whitewater Center. Those stories and more during the weekly news roundup on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the number of displaced people around the world last year exceeded 60 million, the highest number ever recorded by the United Nations. The global refugee crisis and how governments in the U.S. and around the world are responding.
That conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. CMPD Police Chief Kerr Putney is our guest for this segment of the program. We're talking about the addition of police officers, which the City Council granted him. He asked for 125 additional officers and some support staff as well to help them behind the scenes. And the City Council has made provisions for, I think, 63 officers.
63 and 25.
And 25 behind the scenes. Some have said that when you ask for 125 officers, that we couldn't even train 125 officers in the course of a year. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what people have said. So did you go on asking for 125 officers because that's what we need, or like any good negotiator, you went in knowing that they're going to cut that number, so let's go with a high number and take what we can get?
Very good question. Well, Mike, I'm not a very good negotiator. We did a lot of analysis 8 years ago, and we needed 250.
Wow.
And that's what we asked for. We got 125. So I just went specifically with what I know we need.
Well, if you got 250 additional officers, what would that mean? How would that change the department? How would that change the crime rate? How would that change your visibility on the street, et cetera?
Well, the 250 wasn't my ask. It was 8 years ago. But okay. I can tell you what 125 gets us today. It gets us about 266,000 police service hours. So that's a lot of proactive work. That's a lot of engagement. That's a lot of crime fighting. And that's a lot of crimes prevented.
So 63 officers on the street, new officers. On the, when will they come into the force?
Over the course of the next 12 months. Okay. And the whole allotment of the 63 should be in place by fall of 2017.
And what will the impact of those additional officers?
That's half, so you're getting about 130,000. The big impact that I see, though, is the growth of Charlotte. We have a greenway that's going to be basically a marathon from one side of the county to the other. And as we grow and build infrastructure, we need to think about public safety. Mm-hmm. And this gives us an opportunity now to make some of those growth areas safer for the citizens who use them.
So as we continue to grow, and we do continue to grow, you're going to need more officers. And you've just painted the Greenway as a highway for potential crime or a need to have patrol officers on those.
Highway that'll need safety.
That'll need safety. Okay. So would you be back next year to ask for more additional officers because you didn't get what you wanted in the first place or what you needed in the first place?
Fair question. It's just a matter of how many I'll be requesting. What I'm also doing, Mike, is making a longitudinal look at our needs over the next 3 to 5 years. I don't want to come with a big ticket item and ask for 125. I mean, that was something that bothered me greatly because I know it's a burden on taxpayers.
Yeah.
But what I want to do is make sure people aren't surprised as we grow as a city over the next 3 to 5 years. There are going to be public safety needs, and I want people prepared to know what they are.
In the 90s, you point out that the department added 100 officers and saw a reduction in crime. Do you anticipate a repeat of that statistic with these additional officers coming on board?
I've been advised to shy away from that, but I'm not going to. Yes, you will see a reduction. We did the same thing in 2008, and from 2009 and 10 when we onboarded all 125, we dropped over the next 6 years by 30% in overall crime rate. So do I expect to see similar results? Yes. Can I guarantee it'll be 30%? No. But we will reduce crime over the next years as we onboard our additional officers.
So how and where will these officers be deployed?
Well, right now we have a lot of statistical analyses that show us where they should go by ratio, by size of division and so forth. But ultimately, they're going to go all over the city. Our primary focus of staffing them will be in patrol, out in areas where they can be most proactive and efficient. But over the next 2 to 3 years, we also need to grow our investigative capacities.
And that is your goal with these additional officers, and it would have been your goal even more so with the 125 that you asked for, to be more proactive rather than reactive. How does that operate in the real world?
Well, here's the big thing for us is we know the traditional quote-unquote hotspots for crime, and we know where to deploy our people. The problem is our capacity to be proactive in those areas has been limited because the call volume has increased by 20% over the last year. So we're responding to calls, and we are drawn to react to calls more so than proactively go put our people there to prevent them.
I know that you've put walking patrol officers on the beat in some of these higher crime areas, and you report that after a short period of time, you're seeing less people hanging around on street corners, getting into trouble and things like that. But how do you know that they're just not aware that, oh, this guy's going to walk this beat every day at this time, and they're timing it out so that they're hanging around on the corners when he's not there, or they simply move to a different corner? How do you know?
Well, either way, it's a success. If you're off the corner that you were loitering on and you were causing problems and now you're not, then we're good with that. But ultimately, though, it's getting our officers out there to engage with the community so we can see the positives, because a lot of our people see all the negatives, and this is an opportunity to be proactive, put them strategically in places that need us the most, and make some engagement with the public to build that trust.
And you said that you want to go after people in the right way, to take them out of play so we can reduce crime. What does it mean to go after them the right way?
We want to make sure we can always meet the legal standard, but Charlotte is better than that. So we're going to treat people with fairness and respect, but those who need to be behind bars, we're going to put them there. We're going to abide by the laws. We're not going to violate anybody's rights, but we're going to aggressively make sure we're protecting those people who are most vulnerable.
Crime rates tend to go up everywhere in the summertime. I'm not sure why. I'm sure there's a multitude of reasons, but you've already launched an operation to run through the summer to focus on violent crime and the people who prey on members of the community. I think those are the department's words. So what are you doing?
Well, ultimately, what we're doing is, unfortunately, we're having to rob Peter to pay Paul, but we're pulling a lot of resources from around the city to focus in concentrated areas that I spoke of before, and to make sure we're really focused on, the people who are carrying firearms illegally and who are creating that level of violence that we spoke of earlier.
And you did this in 2014.
Yes.
What was the result of that?
Yeah, 2014, every time we do it in the areas that we are, we reduce crime. Basically, like you said, sometimes it is displacement. Mm-hmm. But also, though, what we're seeing is we're able to disrupt the activity that people are comfortable performing in certain areas. Meaning, if I'm going to be a person who's a career criminal and my area of expertise is right here in your studio, moving me out of your studio disrupts my business. So it makes me a little bit uneasy, a bit gun shy, because now I have to go in and reestablish myself. And that gives us an opportunity to come in and move you out and establish better relationships so that people will report you if you come back. It gives us an opportunity to really fundamentally change areas.
You started this on May 9th, so we're about almost 2 months into it. Have you seen results?
Yeah, actually we have. We've reduced violent crime in the areas that we're focused about 15%. We're also we've arrested a number of people, about seven who were gun offenders, and we've arrested about 60 people total in those areas to, again, eradicate that chronic criminal victimization.
I know that, and we've talked about this with you and other people within the department and outside of the department, that I know that you have been working with people to try to tell them, teach them alternatives to crime and alternatives to using a gun and showing them a better path to a better life. Those efforts are ongoing? They're still ongoing?
Sure. I think we're going to measure them a bit better at year end of 2016, though. We divert about 1,000 young people a year, but to me, diverting them out of the system is just step one. Mm-hmm. We also are working with partners who can give them conflict resolution skills, job skills, and ultimately I want to see them employed. Mm-hmm. So the measure is going to be a higher standard at the end of the year, because if we're really trying to change lives and impact people and make the city safer, we need to make sure people are employable.
I understand you also want to expand the use of body cameras. That's something that was touted as having a potentially increasing trust in the police after a very difficult couple of years for departments across the country with incidents that have occurred. All patrol officers have these body cameras now, I understand. But in recent months, making footage from those body cameras available to the media and to the public at large has been difficult. Why, if the justification for those cameras and the expense for those cameras was that we can make the department more transparent, are we now holding back on showing the video that these cameras are recording?
That's an interesting perspective. Actually, if you feel you've been wronged in any way by the police, all the public has access. They can see that footage that is relevant to their complaint. So the other part of it was, you said, the media and having it just released to the public in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that that's not in line with the law right now. So if it's specific to an investigation, obviously it can hamper the investigation, so we wouldn't release it. But if there's an aggrieved person who has a specific complaint on an officer that is captured on body-worn camera, mm-hmm. they can see it. That has always been a policy and continues to be a policy.
So they have a use of it, and they could take it to court with them. The media is being a crybaby because we want to be able to show it on television, and that's pretty much against the law in some cases, given where the case is in the process.
In the investigative process, sure.
So we should stop being crybabies because I'm paraphrasing your words here.
Is that paraphrasing? I get your point. Ultimately, the media would like us to post everything. Sure.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is any aggrieved party has access. They can view it. And that's always been our policy, continues to be our policy, and even the new legislation being proposed allows for that.
So let me rephrase.
Sure.
We're not being fair in the way we are presenting this information because the people who need this to defend themselves or to bring accusations to the police department of misconduct on the part of police have access to this footage. They can see it and they can use it.
They can absolutely see it. We won't release it to them, but they can see it. Thus,
could they use it in a court?
If they have a it's going to be used in court anyway if it's part of a criminal case. Okay. So the point of it going to court is it always gets there. But my point is it's perceived and presented as if people who have a legitimate complaint can't see the video, and that's totally inaccurate. They do have access.
Chief Kerr Putney, I have to let you go because I know you have another meeting to go to, but I want to thank you for the time you've spent with us this morning. I appreciate it.
As always, Mike, thank you for having me.
CMPD Chief Kerr Putney. Well, over protests from opponents, the I-77 toll lanes north of Charlotte have been approved and construction has begun, obviously, but that has not stopped the opposition, and even those at the state level have started looking into what canceling the project may mean for the state monetarily. And now, political fallout has begun to spread among those who supported and continue to support the project. WFAE's David Borax has been reporting on this for months, and we've asked him to join us for the remainder of the program to update us on the project. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
And to enlighten us on the political aspect of what's happened and what is likely to happen in the future, Dr. Michael Bitzer is joining us. He's provost and professor of political science at Catawba College in Salisbury. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
There was a flurry of discussion surrounding the possibility of canceling the contract with Cintra and their subpartner, I-77 Mobility Partners, in recent weeks. Has the fact that the state Senate committee has decided not to move a House bill to the full Senate for a vote effectively ended any possibility that this contract will be canceled?
Well, Mike, I think it's going to be very difficult. You know, there are still a few avenues open to the people who oppose the toll lanes. But if you talk to the folks in the state legislature, they think that it's highly unlikely that the state will do anything to cancel this contract. I suppose the only thing left would be a legal challenge. The Senate Transportation Committee Chair Bill Rabin said just yesterday that the Senate's not going to take up the bill and that canceling the contracts and still widening the road, which everyone wants, is going to be too expensive, and it would send a bad signal to other companies that might want to do business with the DOT. And State Senator Jeff Tart says the news this week means that the bill is dead and the project is going forward.
You know, you can advertise that managed lanes will be coming to a town and county near you soon. And it's completely unfortunate because the contract is an abject mess.
So there is this coalition of business leaders and citizens and local officials in the Lake Norman area who don't like the toll lanes. You know, they passed resolutions, they held protests on highway bridges, they filed a lawsuit, and they've been lobbying officials against this. You know, a judge ruled against them in January. That was one big strike. Now their attempt to cancel the contract in the legislature is dead, too. I talked to Kurt Noss from Cornelius. He's the leader of the anti-toll group Widen I-77, and he's done a lot of research into this project and others around the country, and he thinks that the Senate made a mistake.
So what the Senate did was they refused to cancel a project that, if history is any guide, is going to go under in 10 years. There has not been a single private toll lane or toll road project in the United States that has lasted 15 years under its original ownership. They've all either gone bankrupt, or they've been sold, or they've been taken over by the municipality.
So you asked what's left. Widen I-77 did file a lawsuit last year, which they lost in court in Mecklenburg County. They have filed notice that they're going to do an appeal at some point. When I talked to these folks yesterday, they were planning a meeting to talk about their strategy going forward. They are making preparations to file an appeal. They'd like to see it go right to the state Supreme Court because they think there are issues here that would affect that.
Obviously, the opponents are going to be strongest in the Lake Norman, Huntersville, Cornelius, Davidson area because that's the area affected by this now and for the next 50 years if this project goes through. And there seems to be no movement in Raleigh in favor of canceling these toll lanes. Is that political deafness, Dr. Bitzer?
It potentially could be, particularly this fall. If you look at those North Mecklenburg precincts and how they voted, in those precincts, Mitt Romney won with 60%. Pat McCrory won with 72% of the vote. And I think the combination of the I-77 toll lanes chaos and disgruntlement combined with the Charlotte anger at its former mayor and governor who's seeking re-election now could potentially have a huge impact on how many votes Pat McCrory wins out of Mecklenburg County as a whole. Mitt Romney had only 38% of the votes coming out of Mecklenburg in 2012, but Pat McCrory barely won Mecklenburg County with 49%. I think he could easily lose 50,000 plus votes coming out of this fall's election. And if that's the case, and if it is a competitive election, you have basically ticked off one of the state's largest vote counties. This could be a real danger sign.
For the longest time, the opponents were fairly vocal, and a lot of people were just ignoring them, thinking, well, the state obviously must have done their homework on this, and these guys are just disgruntled. But we've had them on, and they seem to know more about this project than a lot of the lawmakers seem to know about. They turned up some very inconvenient information about Sintra and about their track record, et cetera, and they seem to be better informed than a lot of the proponents. Would you say that's accurate, or is that just my misconception of the situation?
I think you're accurate in saying that they've done a lot of research, and they have brought to light a lot of, as you say, inconvenient information about this project and about other projects that Sintra has been involved in. You know, the state leaders are not going to bring up what's going on in other states, too, because it doesn't reflect well on their own contract. However, they are wedded to the contract, and I think they're going to go through with it.
We'll come back and talk more about this and what may or may not happen next in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Steely Dan with guest Steve Winwood, Saturday, July 2nd at PNC Music Pavilion, Charlotte. Tickets at livenation.com. The number of displaced people around the world last year exceeded 60 million. That's the highest number ever recorded by the United Nations. The global refugee crisis and how governments in the U.S. and around the world are responding. The topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Reeb Show. We will continue our conversation about toll lanes on I-77. Where are they going? What will happen next? Stay tuned. That's all upcoming. And you can join the conversation if you'd like to at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
I'm WFAE General Manager Joe O'Connor. On behalf of the entire staff of WFAE, thank you to the nearly 2,000 people who donated during our summer fundraising campaign. We're honored to have your support, which is invested right back into the programs and journalism you rely on. If you've not yet shown your support for WFAE, please consider doing so today at WFAE.org, and thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This segment, we're talking about the I-77 toll road, which, of course, was shot down with a vote in the Senate on a House bill that had already passed to stop the toll road, ended this week in the Senate, and that ends it for the short session. We're talking about all this with David Borax, a reporter for WFAE News, and Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost of and political science professor at Catawba College. It was after opponents of these lanes had been talking about the viability of Cintra, which is the Spanish-owned company that would be building and running these lanes through I-77 Mobility Partners, that the media and the Secretary of Transportation went to Texas to talk to Cintra. The media turned up a troubling track record for this company running toll lanes in other parts of the country, including in Texas and Indiana and Illinois. What did Nick Tennyson, who heads the NCDOT, discover?
Well, we haven't had an actual formal report from him.
Why not?
I'm not sure. It's a great question. We've asked the DOT about that, and we haven't gotten anything back. But, you know, I think the bottom line here is that the DOT is in the middle of this contract, and they see it as extremely expensive to get out of it, and they're going to try and make the best of it if they can. They've talked about, you know, maybe doing some modifications to the contract, but, again, we haven't seen any more on that. So that leaves us with a project that's already underway, and looks like we're going to have these tolling.
So Nick Tennyson went to Texas to talk to Cintra and allegedly to file a report with the purpose of filing a report before the short session began. And State Senate Leader Phil Berger said back on April 20th before the short session began that he would not support any legislation to kill the project.
The I-77 toll lanes issue has been around for a while. I think we've gone pretty far down the road on that. I don't see any need for any significant changes. I have not, up to this point, received any information that would lead me to believe that stopping the project is the right thing to do.
So are we to take from that comment that Nick Tennyson didn't report to anybody in the Senate either?
Well, I think he has. I mean, we know that he has met with Senate leaders. You know, there's been lobbying on both sides here. And the lobbying from the DOT is we don't want to cancel this contract, you know. And I think that's the direction they're going in, you know.
Because it's too expensive to get out of, or because they didn't do enough due diligence in the first place and it would be embarrassing now to back away?
Well, probably both of those. Okay. Go ahead.
That's all right. Well, how big is the opposition to this in this part of the world? How big a faction is this? Do we know?
I don't think we know. The opponents of the toll lanes will cite online polls that say, you know, 98% of people are opposed to it. I live in North Mecklenburg, and I think that you see signs on people's lawns, you see these protests, you see meetings happening, and so there's clearly a loud and vocal opposition to it. What you don't hear is people at cocktail parties or, you know, talking with friends. You don't hear people saying, you know, I think I'm going to take those lanes. And we know from other cities that some people will. Now, will it be enough to support Cintra and give them enough revenue to carry out this contract? We don't know.
Okay. Well, the track record is that the answer is no in other parts of the country, and I don't know why. Do we know why they have been not successful in other parts of the country where ultimately either the project goes bankrupt and somebody else takes it over? What's going on there?
I need to correct the record just a little bit.
All right.
You know, there are successful toll lane projects and toll road projects around the country, and
do they run them?
Does Cintra run them? They run some of them, and some are run by departments of transportation.
Okay.
They are something that people rely on to get from, you know, where they live to a job that they might not otherwise be able to hold if the commute was too long. So it does speed people's road to work. And, you know, that's what this is all about. It's not really about reducing congestion. And in spite of what some folks in the DOT have said, it's really about getting people faster from point A to point B. So there are some projects around the country that do work, and there are places where people use these. One of the questions that the opponents have raised, rightly, I think, is whether this market is big enough to support a project like this? And I don't know what the answer to that is. But back to your question about do people support these, we haven't had a scientific poll that talks to enough people that I think we can be confident about and know whether they support them or not.
Well, no matter how big or small the opposition may be, there's already been political fallout. Dr. Bitzer, along with the Huntersville's former mayor, Jill Swain, who lost her office along with two town commissioners back in the last election, due largely, I believe, to their support of these lanes. And most recently, the Cornelius Town Board took a unanimous vote of no confidence and called on the town's mayor, Chuck Travis, to resign. They called him a traitor and a liar for having gone to Raleigh to meet with legislative leaders of these who supported these lanes. He supported them too, I understand. So put all this into perspective, Dr. Bitzer. This seems like a groundswell.
It certainly seems like that to me. I would agree with David. We don't have any real sense of the true public opinion out of this area. But I dare say with the tea leaves from last year's local elections, every local official in North Mecklenburg and probably South Iredale County as well is going to be running scared if they're on the ballot this fall. And I think you see that in folks like Charlie Jeter, who's part of his district, stretches into North Mecklenburg. He has become a very vocal opponent, and his district is very much a swing kind of district. It could vote for a Democrat or a Republican at the top of the ticket, and I think what we're seeing here in North Carolina is once you vote at the top of the ticket, you pretty much vote that same way down the ballot. And if this is going to be a race at the presidential, gubernatorial, U.S. Senate, even down to state house, state senate, local offices, it's all going to be about who shows up. And what we tend to know is if you are angry, if you are mad, if you feel threatened, you are much more likely to show up and express that anger. And I would not place any bets in terms of how those areas of North Mecklenburg and South Iredale are going to react other than they are not happy with the current slate.
David.
Well, let's talk about how it went in the gubernatorial primary, Michael. If you remember that Robert Brawley, the Republican from Mooresville, beat the governor in six precincts in South Iredale and North Meck. His support was only about 10.5% statewide. But he won nearly.
Did he beat the governor because of his opposition to the toll lanes?
I'm pretty sure that most people who voted for him were really voting against toll lanes.
Okay.
But he won nearly 40% of the vote in Iredell and about 16% in Mecklenburg. But I do think we have to ask at this point, how will that translate into the governor's race in November?
Well, he's now thrown his support to the governor.
Yeah, and so the next question is, how many of those people that voted against McCrory in the primary will do so again in the general election when the opposition candidate is a Democrat? And Brawley did, the night of the election, he sent a text to the governor saying he was going to support him.
Some toll lane opponents blame Governor McCrory for this deal. Are they right to put the blame on him, or is he just a convenient target?
It was his DOT that did this. It was, going a little deeper on it, it's a state policy right now to look at managed lanes or toll lanes as a potential solution in areas where the roads need to be widened and where we don't have the road funding to do this. I mean, this all comes back to the fact that North Carolina has a big deficit in the amount of money available to spend on roads. And when state leaders were looking at this a few years ago, they came up with this idea of doing managed lanes and bringing in a private contractor like Cintra, which is actually financing most of the cost of this. And so I think that is where they want to go with this. I do think that the idea is a tough one to sell right now, but there are plans for other toll roads in Mecklenburg County even as we speak.
We talked about, Michael, we talked about reaction to Cornelius Mayor Chuck Travis going to Raleigh to talk to legislators. He wasn't unaccompanied. He went there with Davidson Mayor John Woods, who attended a June 8th town day meeting with state legislators. Has he been the recipient of any backlash for having gone there?
Not. I'll be honest. I do not know what the reaction in the Davidson area has been to it. So I can't honestly say that there has been strong reaction one way or the other.
Yeah, let me jump in here. So I've talked to both Chuck Travis and John Woods over the past week since this happened. on the same night that the Cornelius Board voted to censure the governor, over, the mayor over that trip, the Davidson Board also met and had a discussion about the toll lane issue. They did not adopt as strong a measure, criticizing the mayor. But during some of the discussion, you could see that there was some unhappiness with this trip up there. But they did pass a resolution reaffirming their opposition to this contract, while also saying they support the idea of toll lanes in principle. So it's a little more nuanced.
The people who are opposed to the contract are not necessarily opposed to the idea of toll lanes, as you just pointed out. What is it about this contract? Is it simply the fact that Cintra, or any company for that matter, having control of these lanes for 50 years, would lock down any hope of expanding the free lanes that are on either side of these toll lanes? Is that what the problem is here?
You know, they don't like the 50 years. They don't like the fact, really, that this area did not get attention from the DOT before now, and that this is what we are left with. They don't like it that it's a foreign company, that they've made a lot of that, you know, discussing that profits are going to leave the country and all that. I'm not sure, you know, they are hiring a lot of local contractors, and it will bring money to the economy here, but... But I think the biggest thing is the idea that the way that managed lanes work is that the price for the toll lanes rises and falls according to how much traffic there is on the road, and Cintra will profit when there is more traffic in the regular lanes. And
there's no incentive to expand the regular lanes. In fact, it's a disincentive to them to expand the regular lanes,
right,
the free lanes.
So there'll be no expansion of it. And in fact, you know, at peak rush hour, I think you will still be going slowly in those regular lanes, and I think people do not like the sound of that.
You mentioned, Michael, State Representative Charles Jeter. He and State Senator Jeff Tarte of Cornelius were at first in favor of these toll lanes, and now they have changed their minds. Is that because they've read the political tea leaves, or is it because they've come across some substantive information that changed their minds?
It certainly could be both, but I think the political reality is any elected official, his or her main objective is to get reelected. And I think, you know, tapping into certainly the anger and the discontent that they see within their districts is something that they had to be politically astute and aware of if they were going to run for reelection. And I think any time a politician ignores what happens back in the district, they do so at their own peril in terms of reelection.
Mm. So one of the issues is going to be how strong is the opposition against these guys? You know, Senator Jeff Tarte, who you just mentioned, is in the 41st Senate District, and he's got a Democrat and a Libertarian running against him. But I don't think that in that district, which is so heavily Republican, I don't think he's going to face a strong challenge. You know, will there be a strong anti-toll vote against him? He's also been working for this. So I think, you know, you are going to have folks in the community who aren't going to turn their backs on Tarte. I think the 92nd District with Charles Jeter is a different story. It's a little closer in terms of Republican, Democrat, and independent registrations. And there is an outside chance, I think, that somebody could come in and beat him. And he's going to be facing Democrat Charles Beasley, who, after hearing the news this week, actually this morning, put out a press release criticizing Jeter for changing his stand on the toll lanes. And, you know, there are also other outside groups, progressive groups in North Carolina, that during the primaries were running billboards and advertisements against Jeter. And he could face that again in the general election, and that could make it a close one for him.
Some say that the political losses by local office holders should send a loud and clear message, at least from this region, to Governor McCrory, who's up for re-election this year. And is this a bigger issue for the governor than HB2, or is it only a bigger issue in this part of the state?
I'd have to think that it is contained within this part of the state. There may be some usage of it in other parts of the state to say, look what Charlotte is going through. Do we want toll lanes down in Raleigh? Do we want them, you know, down east?
Well, the state has already said future highway projects will all be toll lanes. So I was going to ask, is this being watched carefully by either politicians in or citizens in other parts of the state, particularly in the big areas like Guilford and Wake County?
I would have to think that probably the awareness by voters is not that strong. Probably the candidates and their campaign strategists are looking at this, and particularly folks within the governor's administration as well. whether it's going to spread like wildfire across the state, I'm doubtful on that. I think, you know, the broader implications of things like HB2 would probably have a greater effect. Probably the greatest effect is going to be at the top of the ticket, the presidential candidates and how their influence going on down ballot. And we know that partisan behavior of voters tend to very closely align with how they self-identify. Now, will Republicans just simply either skip the top of the ticket and maybe withhold their vote for governor as well? That could be just as powerful an impact as voting for his opponent.
What has Roy Cooper said about this?
Roy Cooper has not said much about the toll lanes. I think he put out a press release in the fall saying something about the contract. But I'm going to agree with Michael that this is really a local issue in Lake Norman right now, and that, you know, it hasn't even spread really to Charlotte.
So where does this go from here? The House bill was sent to the Senate. They are not even going to get it out of committee. That's it for the rest of the short session. What happens next, if anything?
Well, they could always bring up another bill in the next regular session.
Would it originate in the House or would it originate in the Senate?
I think it would work the same way, because you've really got to get a support from the folks in the House before it gets to the Senate. And I think it was because this is an election year, it came up this time because, you know, we haven't really talked about this, but a lot of the politicians involved here are looking for political cover on this. And there was a lot of House trading to get that bill through the House with the margin that it got.
So they just wanted to be on record with the voters that they were trying to stop this project, even though they knew it would not be successful. If it comes up again, is the outcome likely to change?
It might change next time around. It might not get as far.
David Borax, reporter for WFAE News, has reported on this consistently, and we will continue to keep our eye on this as it continues to develop. Dr. Michael Bitzer, provost and political science professor at Catawba College, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Michael.